The phenomenon that you see with energy production, just as an aside here, is that, you know, it's helpful to understand when you say energy, you're literally talking about solar power, right? You're talking about this power of the sun itself. And the way in which this is done is so extraordinary on this planet, in that when the sun emits light, energy, this electromagnetic field, it's a nuclear reaction on the surface of the sun that's happening, and it's putting out this huge electromagnetic field, and there is no thermal consequence to it in space. And so you have a temperature of -260 degrees, and you're near absolute zero. Maybe it was -240, whatever it is. And so you at this freezing state, just seconds off of the surface of the sun.
Whoa, that's something I've never heard before. So the sun's not that hot.
The sun isn't hot.
Because it has nothing to heat up, right?
That's,
I guess.
Exactly right. So it's interfacing with a vacuum. The sun doesn't have a pocket of air around it to heat.
I can't wait to just drop that on someone. It's hot as the sun in here. And I'll be like, oh yeah?
-200.
You're fucking cold as shit, huh? Yeah. Yeah. And I'll be like, what? And I'm like, let me drop some science. Thanks to Dr. Bush.
The coldest stuff on earth, right? And so you have a massive electromagnetic field being produced by this radiation event, this nuclear event on the surface of the sun. And it pulses this electromagnetic energy through the universe. And then it suddenly hits the surface of Earth's atmosphere, and we get something we call heat. So we get a thermal reaction. There's a literal translation happening in the physics of the situation. So you've got this huge electromagnetic field that's moving in the form of light energy and magnetism that then hits the surface of the Earth and is translated into thermodynamics. And so you go into a heat phenomenon. In that thermal induction, you have the potential to change the forms of water and carbon. And in the plants, this took on the form of plastids, which are basically mitochondria that live in plants instead of multicellular biology on the animal side. They come in many forms, these plastids, and they do many cool things that lead to the medicine within our food and all kinds of interesting things. But the most famous one, obviously, is chlorophyll, which then takes that thermal energy from the sun, turns it back into an electromagnetic event. And so you're no longer thermal. You're now going into a release of electrical energy that's then put into the reaction between carbon molecules. So now you can take CO2 and build it into large carbohydrates or fats. And so that was the beginning of this, you know, move towards a respiratory potential for the mitochondria. And so plants, as they start to do photosynthesis, they're capturing and translating solar event, you know, from the sun into a carbohydrate. And then that carbohydrate put into the environment can be consumed now by a respiratory bacteria or a multicellular mammal, ultimately, that can then put that into the bloodstream, get that down to the point where it can reach a mitochondrion, and the mitochondrion then reverses the whole process. The mitochondria takes these large carbohydrates and fats. And, you know, so many of us spend so much time talking about low-fat diets, high-fat diets, high-protein diets, carbohydrates. The mitochondria don't care what the hell you're eating. They're going to do the same thing. So it turns out the only fuels, obviously, they can use are carbohydrates and fats. Proteins are not fuel. And so you get carbohydrates and fats, which are long-chain carbon structures that are broken down into the exact same molecule in a one enzyme step in the surface of a mitochondria. They take both a fat and a sugar and they turn it immediately into acetyl-CoA. And then they, in one more enzyme jump, and you get acyl-CoA first and then acetyl-CoA. And so you get these two enzymes to take it down into acetyl-CoA. And now that goes into the Krebs cycle and all of this. And the Krebs cycle, we say, makes ATP. Yes, it does. At the end of the respiratory cycle, you get ATP, which we're told is the fuel for the human energy, you know, source there. But in a lot of ways, I think that's erroneous. I think we're starting to realize, no, it's all the electricity that's released during the breakdown of those carbon molecules. And so at almost every level of this complex, you know, chain of events through the enzymes within the mitochondria, you're releasing electrons. And what you're literally doing is taking the electromagnetic field of the sun, waiting for it to hit the surface of the planet. From there, then translates it into carbohydrate, Now you have carbohydrate carrying the power of the sun. Carbohydrate breaks down, and you now get the release of that. And now you've released energy in the body in the form of sunshine. And and if you think about, you know, a cubic centimeter of mitochondria, which pack our cells, there's, if you go to a biology textbook and look up, you know, mitochondria, it'll show two mitochondria typically floating inside of the plasma of the human cell. They can't depict it accurately because you wouldn't be able to see anything within the cell except mitochondria if they did it right. The average human cell has 200 mitochondria, and
it's like a bowl of popcorn. It's a bowl of popcorn. Being mitochondria.
It's stuffed full of them.
Yeah.
And a neuron has 2,000 mitochondria in the cytoplasm. Wow. And so you've got these huge populations that just pack the insides of these cells. So when you talk about a cubic centimeter of tissue, you're darn near a cubic centimeter of mitochondria. And that cubic centimeter of mitochondria can produce 10,000 times more electromagnetic field energy than a cubic centimeter of the sun. And so you've got this nuclear event going on inside your body that is actually more efficient than nuclear fission. And we actually are doing fusion events and then refission events at this molecular level to create this solar event. And so this is one of my favorite things about being alive, is the opportunity to give each other hugs. Because what you're literally doing is bringing yourself into the sunshine of another human being, because that field emanates far beyond the physical body. And this is my favorite thing about being alive as a scientist right now, is our tools are getting so cool because they're starting to blend the biologic with the metaphysical environment. And so we're starting to be able to measure the reaction of plants to a human emotion. And that's exciting, you know, to understand that the love you have for your garden can be measured in the biologic field now in the form of enzymatic work and other things, you know. And so you can show an increase in that metabolic reserve, the increase in the energy capacity of that garden as you come in as a loving being and you approach with your solar radiation event. All of the chlorophyll in that plant are going to have to respond to you, right? If you come in a low magnetic field resonance state, and two of the most powerful ways to lower your field almost instantly are, again, human emotions. And one of them is fear, and the other one is guilt. And so this is an interesting look at our last, you know, 8 months of this pandemic. Is the two tools that are always exercised is, first, fear. You got to be afraid of this virus. You got to be afraid of this. And then if that's not powerful enough, guilt. If you don't wear a mask, you make somebody else sick. Your grandma might die because you didn't wear a mask or whatever. So this fear,
and not your
guilt
grandma,
message.
But some other person's grandma. You're killing other people because of your selfish act. So again, yes, it's the fear of your own mortality, and then the guilt. And both of those have been ramped up. I mean, we're seeing it right now. I mean, they're redlining. I mean, the gauge is like running on red, like RPMs of an engine that's about to collapse. It's like, y'all really? Like, it's fucking, and people aren't looking at the consequences of these things and measuring it against, what are we actually talking about here? You know, we're doing this thing globally to prevent in quotes, you know, this thing. And the science of that is dubious to begin with anyways, right? But it's that's, I think, the most frustrating part of the conversation, is just that it's so myopic and so manipulative the way that it's going, that it's, nobody's talking about the breadth of the situation, the allocation of resources, the unintended cost on the human energetics.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really well said. And we've come to realize that all chronic disease can be mapped back to this dysfunction within it. And so in my clinic, for example, one of the primary tools we use in an initial visit is something called the phase angle, which measures the electrical potential across a single membrane. It's showing you how much charged energy, how much electromagnetic field are you producing. And a healthy body measures out with a metric of like 10 to 13 on the scale that you measure the phase angle. And cancer always occurs around 4 to 5, and death occurs at 3.5. And so it's a good demonstration of the fact that chronic disease emerges as a result of this failed energy production. It's never attacking us. There's no disease that's ever leapt up and attacked a healthy human cell. You don't get disease with a phase angle of 13. Yeah, you are so resilient, you can repair faster than any injury can imagine itself. and you're really in the quantum state of energy at that point, where repair is so instantaneous because it's all built around coherent waveform of energy. So it doesn't even take like protein synthesis and genomics. You're literally just in a wave state, that harmonic we were talking about earlier. You can phase shift that cell so that it's at this high harmonic level, and it becomes so resilient because there's no static that can come in to disrupt that signal. As we start to decay and push things down into this lower vibration state, we will see these things pop up. And it's interesting to see, you know, most cancers peering at a phase angle of 4.5 and death at 3.5. You're so close to a complete incapacity for life by the time most cancers will show up. And so it's really intriguing as we start to untangle something as simple as a mitochondria to understand that life force that we would understand as a centropic event, as the centropy that's organizing the chaos, which of course is in total flow of intention. The chaos is not out of its order, but the chaos in its relative disorganization as it comes into a centropy in something like a mitochondria produces so much energy that it becomes its own vortex for creation. And so you get this creative force within a cell that knows what to do, that knows, you know, beyond its genomics, beyond everything else, it knows its drive for life. And I've certainly seen this under a microscope studying cancer cells. Even a cancer cell in the end, in its, you know, highly damaged state, you've got a cell that now has on average 15,000 to 25,000 unrepaired genetic injuries that are impairing its ability to produce its own repair pathways, energetic pathways, all of this. That collapsing cell that has no more genomic opportunity to actually survive, it still has its drive for life. Mm-hmm. So deeper than the genomics, deeper than the ability to repair, is this drive for life. And so since it can't repair anymore, since it can't reach out, it's become totally isolated. So you can't get a cancer cell until you have complete loneliness. You have to have total isolation, mm-hmm. which is interesting to think about social levels of cancer. And then again, we tell everybody go into their house, stay away from people, isolate. We're asking everybody to come become their own form of cancer at that philosophical level. Yep. And so in the isolation, the cell now comes to believe it's the last semblance of life. It doesn't understand it's part of a 70 trillion celled organism that has, you know, this whole abundance of life within it. And so in that, though, it doesn't give up. Instead, it says, well, the only option left is reproduction. And so it goes into this rapid cell division state, which we call a tumor or a cancer. But in fact, it's the most pure state of survival. It's the most pure state of drive for life. In the same way, I didn't know I was going to go into medicine historically. I was in construction and engineering and thought I was going that direction with my life, and then got the opportunity to go over to the Philippines with an aunt of mine, took a year off from, before going into my engineering program, and went over and birthed babies with this group of international midwives. And the first child I ever birthed alone was by accident. It was a woman was dropped off in our on our doorstep at like 3 o'clock in the morning, rang the doorbell. Somebody rang the doorbell, ran off, and we opened the door. And it was this tragic story of this woman who was nonverbal, had been born with severe brain damage. She was probably in her 20s. Had been raped and had become pregnant, and in her kind of, you know, damaged state, unable to communicate ever in her life, really, she's now hemorrhaging on our doorstep at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we put her in the van. We've never seen her before. We weren't prepared to help her out. We go rushing to the nearest hospital is the plan. And so we're driving at 3 o'clock in the morning through the streets of Manila, Philippines, and my aunt's driving and I'm in the back seat. And I'm only like 19 years old at this point. No medical experience that you would excuse for anything that would suggest I was qualified to be in this situation at all. And this woman is, you know, almost paralyzed in fear. You know, she's just staring into my eyes with this intense fear on her face, not knowing what she's doing. She doesn't understand she's pregnant. She doesn't understand what's going on. She's hemorrhaging. And she's suddenly, you know, lays back down and she's having a contraction that she doesn't understand. She just knows her body's just in so much pain. And this baby is born in my hands that's extremely premature and is no bigger than my hand, you know, from head to toe. It fits from fingertip to the crease in my wrist. And this little blue baby is laying in my hand. And I can't explain how light this thing feels. Like, it doesn't compute in your brain that you're looking at a perfect human being, because all the toes are there, the fingernails are almost microscopic, but you can see each one. You can see the little tiny semblances of eyelashes. And this little blue baby that lays in your hand for a moment to tell you just how miraculous it is, this thing that we call life. And in the same way that that cancer cell seems impossible to give life, you know, and then finds an out, it finds a drive for life and starts reproducing. That baby started breathing. And over the next couple of minutes, as we're rushing the hospital, it pinks up and lets out its first cry. And it was the most faint sound you can imagine on the human side, but in my receiving of it, I literally felt like somebody was screaming into my soul, like screaming this intense cry, which I burst into tears in the back of this thing, partly just out of my stress and my own fear of being inadequate in this moment, but more just a sense of the injustice that was in that cry, the tragedy that was in that cry. But more than all of that, superseding all of that, was I am alive. This simple message of I am alive right now. And that child went on to die a couple weeks later, you know, despite all the efforts at the little hospital and all of this. But it made it scream in the world.
Yeah.
And I feel like each of us right now have the ability to put that kind of song into the universe of I am alive right now. Humankind may decay and go into its extinction event over the next few decades. The earth may collapse in its sixth great extinction. But I am alive right now, and I'm going to participate in that through my vibration, through my effort to hit a new harmonic for myself. And I am not going to be dragged down by this, you know, as you said, the most intense fear and guilt paradigm we've ever seen on the planet. Despite that tenor, despite that extreme volume of those two vibrations, which are among the lowest we know, how many of us are finding this new freedom to vibrate higher? Which means the old structure, the old power of fear and guilt might be letting go. It might be in its last throes, because if we can think this creatively and we can find each other right now, the people that need to find each other to innovate for the near future that we need tomorrow are finding each other. And I'm glad to make this connection with you right now. Thank you for your time and your attention to this episode of After School. It is an inspiration for me to rewatch these words depicted in an artist's hand that takes us through this journey of understanding how do we become these light beings? How do we animate these flesh suits into something so spectacular? We find each other in these dynamic environments of social stress and economic collapse, ecological collapse, and yet we find each other all of the time. Love is in the air of the environment that we breathe. It is not an emotion. Love, I believe, is actually the vibration of witnessing beauty. And I'm so glad you showed up right now to express that light energy within you, to be part of the magnum opus of humanity. I think we are an unfinished symphony, and the best is yet to come. And we will find that best when we join together to create something more verdant and, frankly, more beautiful than anything we've seen before. It's an honor to be with all of you. I look forward to the next steps.